1,500 views in a week. But I want to, if my stuff will cooperate, I want to revisit just briefly some things here from Sylvia. If you guys recall, last time had a question about the what the little book was in Revelation 10 and this instruction to eat it. And so we sort of had an impromptu, organic conversation about that and what all that meant. And so what I want to do as part of looking at that is, first of all, give Sylvia an opportunity to respond or comment back. She did watch it since last Sunday, but then I wanted to just look at some of the comments that were made on this video, because I think they're somewhat interesting, and we just kind of want to look at what some other feedback that other people gave. There's not a ton of comments, but they might be interesting for us to look at. So Sylvia, we'll start with you. You said you had an opportunity to watch it, and did you have any thoughts or comments or questions or anything as you watched the response?
I didn't have any disagreement. I totally agree with what you said. I mean that it is, I forget the phrase, but it's the...
Figurative,
yes, of eating it. And I don't know why I didn't think of that before, but I did like your process of investigation.
Okay. So those of you that weren't here, which most of you were, but a few of you weren't, what Sylvia had sent me a question, so let's just look at Revelation 10. And we were looking at this passage here, start at verse 8. And the voice which I heard from heaven spake unto me again and said, go and take the little book which is opened in the hand of the angel, which standeth upon the sea and upon the earth. So again, that's the angel. Go back up to verse 1 quick. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud and a rainbow upon his head, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. So we talked about the figurative language there, right? The use of the word as. And he had in his hand a little book open. So there's the first mention in the chapter of the little book. And he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot on the earth. So now verse 8 is giving some further sort of elaboration on a conversation that John has with this angel. Verse 8, and the voice which I heard from heaven spake unto me again and said, go take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel which standeth upon the sea and upon the earth. And I went unto the angel and said unto him, give me the little book. And he said unto me, take it and eat it up, and it shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey, and as soon as I had eaten it, my belly were bitter. And he said unto me, thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. Okay, so the basic question was, what is the little book, and what is this talking about eating it, and this so on and so forth. So we were very organic last Sunday, and what I mean by that is I didn't prepare anything in advance, and we just sort of went through a process of questions and looked at some things from some tools, and that led us to, you know, make some comparisons about other prophetic statements in Jeremiah, and I think the other one might have been in Isaiah, where it was Ezekiel about, you know, eating the roll, eating the words, some of those kinds of things, and then what the prophecy might be. And I had suggested, after we went through sort of a conversation about that maybe the little book is the contents of the book of Revelation itself that John is now going to write about. And we talked about how that was figurative language. Eating the roll, eating the words, eating the book is figurative language for really getting it inside you, making sure that you understand it, etc. Okay? So that was some of what we said. Now, there were some interesting comments that were made about this. And I don't know who any of these people are, so this is not in any way, shape, manner, form designed to pick on anybody. But I just thought it would be interesting to follow up by looking at what some of these comments were. Okay, so there's one long one, and then there's a couple shorter ones. So let's deal with the shorter ones first. So what I'm going to do, I can't stand that YouTube does this now, but we're going to sort this by newest first. Okay, so that's going to put them in chronological order. So anytime you do that, it's going to put the most recent comment at the top and the older comments at the towards the bottom. Okay, so we're going to start at the bottom and work our way up just because of the length of the comments. Okay, so this person says, after watching the video, this ending of the chapter leads me to believe that John is one of the second witnesses. Not sure what they mean, if they mean one of the two witnesses. Taking the ending of John and this chapter's ending, then chapter 11 is the two witnesses. So if you go to chapter 11, go to John chapter 11. I'm sorry, Revelation 11. Just turn the page. And if you look at verse 3, and I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth, and these are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth. And if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. So what this person here in this comment seems to be suggesting is that they think that John is one of the two witnesses then of chapter 11. Okay? I personally do not have that opinion. My understanding of the two witnesses is that they are Moses and Elijah, just based on some of the things that are said about them. Okay? You're in chapter 11, right? So if you start looking at, now why would I say that? All right. Verse 5, if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. Look at verse 6. These have power to shut heaven that it rain not in the days of the prophecy. Well, if you go to who prophesied and shut heaven so that it not rain in the Old Testament? Elijah did that if you go read about it in Kings. Okay? So there's a correlation here between in that regard. Verse 6, these have power to shut heaven that it rain not in the days of the prophecy, and have power over waters to turn them to blood. Who did that? Moses. Okay? So, in my understanding, the two witnesses are Moses and Elijah. Okay? Or they have something to do with Moses and Elijah. And even if you study John the Baptist in the Gospels, okay, John the Baptist, come with me and go to Luke chapter 1. We read this in church last Sunday, but we didn't expound upon it because it was sort of a minor point and I was after bigger points. But when the angel tells Zacharias that he's going to have a son after he's well stricken in years, look at Luke chapter 1 verse 17. Okay? And it says, verse 16, and many of the children of Israel shall turn to their God. In verse 15, he shall be filled with the Holy Ghost, even from his mother's womb. Verse 16, and many of the children of Israel shall turn to their God, and he shall go before him, that would be the Messiah, notice, in the spirit and power of who? Elias. That is a Greek spelling of whose name? Elijah. So John the Baptist, from before he's even born, at the time when his conception is announced to Zacharias, is he tied to Elijah? Okay? There's other verses where Christ is explicitly asked, you know, is John the Baptist Elijah, which was for to come? And he says, well, if you received the kingdom, then he was Elijah. Which, of course, Israel did not receive the kingdom, so does Elijah coming again, so to speak, have a future fulfillment? I think that's what Revelation 11 is talking about. So I take, this is my interpretation, I take Revelation 11, the two witnesses, to be Moses and Elijah. I think that's the way that doesn't mean it's correct, but most dispensational interpreters, I think, would say that the two witnesses here in Revelation 11 are Moses and Elijah. They would not say that it's John. But this is what this commenter said. It seems like a legitimate question. They go on to say, taking the ending of John and this chapter's ending, then chapter 11 is the two witnesses, which they do exactly what the angel said John would later do. So I'm not I read this a few times, and I'm not necessarily following the point, okay? And then there's a comment here, the scroll and the book are similar things, I think, and I think that's related to some of the comments that were made. And then there's this larger comment here, okay? So let's look at this. It says, I think because John is in heaven, the picture we are given may be an accurate representation of what is happening. May be an accurate representation of what is happening, but because we've never been there, so it's hard to see slash understand, that it could actually be a small spiritual book that Christ actually gives John to eat. So this person is saying that maybe he gave him a physical book that he's supposed to eat. This seems to be what they're arguing here. And it actually tastes good because John was curious to know the answers. But that's not the point of the passage. The passage is the point of what happens after he eats the book. That is to tell what the book is because of what the information it contained. I think I can agree with that, right? John, through eating the book, does he get information that he's then going to write about? That seems to me to make sense, okay? The passage, okay, right here. And that was the identity of the two witnesses. It's now John and Moses. So, this person is again saying that the two witnesses are related to the contents of the little book, but they're including John along with Moses as one of the two witnesses. Does everybody see what's going on with that comment? Okay. John is bitter now because he sees he will go through another death, or possibly he doesn't even care about that, but his stomach gets bitter because he better understands the role of the two witnesses, or it could be both of these, etc. I don't think there is an actual specific book. I think the book is a reference to a prophecy that John wanted to know the information to, so God gives him the knowledge in a book, which when John eats it is good because he is excited, but then he sees it's bitter once he digests the information and will be one of the two witnesses. So the person is, the commenter is obviously saying that they're making a connection between John eating the book and then what is said in the next chapter about the two witnesses, okay? I don't think I necessarily have a problem with that concept. My disagreement is whether John himself is one of the two witnesses. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so does anybody else have any questions or comments about either these comments as they were left or anything that I said when we originally went through this last week? Where?
The last 2 lines.
Oh, did I not read all of it?
No, Bible.
Sorry. Also, a good Bible software that is completely free is WordNet. I've never heard of it or used it, so I can't. Because remember, I was talking about Blue Letter Bible. It's talking about the app you can get for your phone and the website that we used last Sunday. Okay. So, and then this person says it's quite a powerful software, and you can download modules for free. I'm sure they're not wrong. I just don't have any familiarity with that particular software. So does anybody have any questions or comments to follow up on what we went through or any of these comments that were left here? So again, I want to make it clear. Like, I'm not trying to criticize anything, but we kept it open-ended, and these are some of the feedback comments that we got. If I go to Facebook, I don't believe there was a ton of comments. So this is us live right there, right now. So everybody wave to yourself, okay? If you come down here, this is where we were last Sunday, and you can see there's no comments there. And I think if we go to the church's page, which is going to give me more problems, so I'm not going to bother with it. So that's basically the gist of the feedback that we got on our little impromptu study last week. Okay? Any questions or comments? Do any of you have anything else or any other Q&A type questions?
One thing that struck me at this reading, I was under the impression in 10:1 that this angel was larger than light, the way it being described.
Yep.
And in 8 and 9, where actually hands him, it sounds like he's human size in that verse, because he hands him the Bible. He doesn't have to, you know, like he's going up to the mountain.
Well, it's an interesting point. Like, is the book described as a little because it's compared to the immensity of the angel?
I don't know.
Or is it little because of the size of it as far as its contents? We don't know. I do agree with you when you look at chapter 10, verse 1. It appears that this is some sort of a colossus, right? Some sort of a... Are you guys familiar with the political cartoon from probably over 150 years ago called The Rhodes Colossus? It's a famous political cartoon where Cecil Rhodes, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, is straddling the continent of Africa, holding in his hands a telegraph line connecting Cairo to Cape Town.
Oh, I think I've seen something like that.
Okay, that's kind of the image I have in mind, and I think that whoever drew that cartoon possibly had in mind this verse when they drew it like that.
If he's got 1 foot in the ocean and 1 on land, just on the shore.
Yeah, it does give you the impression. So let's just read the verse. And I saw another mighty angel. So there's a clue. Like,
yeah,
when you think of mighty, you don't think of like a little pipsqueak angel.
Yeah.
Not that you would think of a pipsqueak when you think of an angel, okay? But there's certain connotation there possibly. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud. So you think a cloud, he's clothed with a cloud. And a rainbow upon his head, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. So you don't get the imagery there that this is some little ordinary angel. You get the idea that this is a massive figure of an angel that John is seeing here. Okay, so I agree with you. I really hadn't thought about your point that later on in verses 8 and 9, you're right, it doesn't seem so grandiose anymore when you read verse 8 and 9. But... yeah, it's an interesting observation. Anybody else? All right, if you don't have anything, turn to Ruth chapter 2. So this week a video was released about a statement here in the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 2. Why can I not find Ruth? Joshua judges Ruth. There we go. Ruth chapter 2. So a video was released this week on a topic here related to verse 16. Okay, now I'm not going to tell you who made the video or anything like that. To me, that's not important. We just want to talk about what this means. All right? So look at Ruth 2, verse 16. It says, so we're just going to read verse 16, and then we'll kind of go through a process on this as well. Verse 16. It says, and let fall also some of the handfuls of purpose for her, and leave them that she may glean them and rebuke her not. Okay? So the question is, what does handfuls of purpose mean? Alright? What does handfuls of purpose mean? So before we do anything else, does anybody have an opinion or thoughts on don't read anything else? Just tell me, what do you think it means at first blush? Handfuls of purpose. What does that mean?
Intentionally.
Intentionally, Ken says intentionally. Anybody else?
I read it kind of on purpose.
On purpose?
Yeah.
Okay, so if something is intentional, it would be being done on purpose. So similar concepts there. Anybody else? Now let me ask you this. Ken and Sylvia, and anyone else can chime in here. What makes you think that's what it means? On purpose or intentionally?
Well, so she can have some gleaning.
Okay. Ken?
Well, typically when farmer does feel there are some losses that somebody could potentially pick up.
Okay, so
what does he have to say?
Okay, interesting. Amy, you look like you want to say something. You're thinking. Okay, does anybody else want to comment? So, of purpose, so handfuls of purpose, we have one person saying they think it means intentionally, another one saying on purpose. Does anybody else have any?
Would handfuls mean like abundant?
Yes, that's the way I see it.
A lot of purpose.
The amount of purpose.
So a lot of intentionality.
Yes.
A lot of on purposeness.
Is it figurative?
What do you mean?
Well, does it have some meaning other than literal?
Okay. So we got a lot of interesting thinking here, and we haven't done anything except read the verse and me ask you some questions, right? You guys with me so far? Let's go to read verse 15 first now, see if it helps. Which obviously it will, because it's the scripture and now you're getting context, but look at verse 15. And when she was risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves and reproach her what? In other words, don't stop her from what?
Glean.
From gleaning. Alright, now read verse 16. And let fall also some of the handfuls of purpose for her. Okay, let fall also some of the handfuls of purpose for her and leave them, that she may glean them and rebuke her not.
Sounds like the young men are dropping things on purpose.
Okay, so are they? So you understand, Eli, that Boaz is instructing his reapers to intentionally drop handfuls for her, which would be Ruth, to what? To pick up. Now, how many of you had a hard time understanding that from the verse?
Well, if you've read the book before, you know.
Okay. Let's say, how many of you, it's been a long time since you've read these verses? Okay. But you come to them, and we haven't done anything as far, any sort of real deep digging or anything around on what this means yet, right? So the suggestion that was made in the video was that people are not going to understand the phrase handfuls of purpose because it's an old way of speaking that isn't used. We don't speak this way anymore, and so therefore we're not going to understand, okay, what handfuls of purpose means. I would suggest that just based on our informal conversation, without me giving you any further details, that we have pretty much already accurately identified what it means. Okay? It essentially means what?
On purpose.
On purpose. Okay? So let's look at a couple things. So, we're going to search the OED for the word purpose. I think. Assuming it cooperates. And so, do we think this is a verb or a noun here? Handfuls of purpose.
No.
I think it's a noun too. So we're going to search the noun. All right. And we're going to turn on all the quotes. Whoops. Did we do that? Yeah, we did that. All right. So now, so we're in the entry for purpose. And we're looking for the phrase what? We're going to, so you can see that I've already cheated and done this, okay? But we're going to look for of purpose. All right. So, if we look in the OED for of purpose, notice what we find. We find A or P1, so this is giving you different phrases. A purpose equals what?
On,
also upon purpose. Then it says phrase what?
Six.
P6. So let's go look at P6. Of purpose, also out of, set purpose, without the following construction, notice, what? Equals what? On purpose, at phrases P6, now it's rare and what? So does the OED have an entry that defines the English phrase of purpose as meaning what?
On purpose.
On purpose. So can we know and understand very clearly that he's leaving and drop, that what Boaz has done is he has ordered his gleaners, his reapers, to intentionally drop handfuls on purpose. Right? Now, did we need to look at the OED for you to get that? I would argue we did not, because did Ken already say it means immediate, you said intentionally, right? And Sylvia, you said what? On purpose. And what did you say again, Eli?
Just read about verse 15. It seems obvious that Boaz has given young men instructions to just, accidentally dropped that.
So accidentally on purpose, right? Yeah, So they're going to make it appear as it's a what?
Accident.
But they're doing it on purpose so that Ruth can come through and do what? Collect up the.
And then handfuls basically is literal handfuls.
Handfuls means the amount of something you can fit in the hand. That's what handfuls means. Okay, so are they going to be dropping handfuls on purpose? So if you look at the verse, go back to Ruth 2. So is there admittedly an older form of the phrase that is now marked rare and archaic in the OED? But did that really stop you from understanding what is going on there?
No.
I don't think so either. Okay, now let's look at one more thing. So now we're going to go to the Lexicons of Early Modern English, which is another website furnished by the... So what this does, guys, is this searches word usages from, in English, between 1450 and 1800. Okay, so this is a very powerful tool to help that you guys can use. So we're going to put in purpose, so you can probably tell I already did this as well. So we're going to get now a host of different entries. Okay, now you could just look at the feedback. So we're going all the way back here to what year? So when you search the phrase when you search the word purpose in the lexicons of early modern English, does it pull examples going all the way back to 1480? Now is that well before the King James Bible?
Yeah.
Okay. Now what we can do, so I'm also trying to teach you how to do some research here, okay? So now that we have a whole bunch, so let's just look. Do we have like a whole bunch of examples now from the lexicons of early modern English? It's going to take 2 hours to read all that, right? So what phrase are we looking for? So now we can hit on this website, Control F, and we can get this window now. So now we can search this website for specific occurrences of what?
Of purpose.
Of purpose. So using two steps, have we now been able to identify in this entry all of the occurrences of purpose?
Yep.
Okay. Now, I already have done this, so we're not going to... You can look literally at every single one of these. So the first one it finds of that exact phrase is from what? Let's just check the year on this. Oops. So this is from 1538. Okay. Now, I already know that I want 1587 because I've already checked this. There's a whole bunch of material here. It would take way too long to go through all of it, and it would be exceedingly boring. So I'm just going to go straight to the one that I want to show you, which I think is the clearest one. And we're going to go to 1587. See, there's just tons of information that you get here when you run these searches. So you know what I'm going to do for the sake of time? I'm going to cheat. And I'm going to go to 1587. Since I already know that's the one I want. And there it is. And I will find that entry right. This one right here. So you say, well, what language is that? Because this is an interlinear. So what you can do now is you can come in here and highlight this, Control C, copy, open up Google Translate. See, it says enter text, it'll detect the language. So I'm going to come in here and I'm going to hit Control V for paste, and it dumps it in And it's Latin, and it translates it for me into English. So this is note. So the entry in the Latin English interlinear from 1587 is an entry for what word?
Knowingly.
Knowingly. Okay? So when I go now, I can go back here to this, and I can look at this entry. So we're looking at knowingly. It's an adverb. Notice, done of what?
Purpose.
Purposely, wittingly, cunningly, skillfully, or with what?
Knowledge.
Knowledge. And this is from 1587. So is there word usage information available to you for free on the internet which would help you understand what this old phrase means? So you don't, if you know how to work the tools, if you know how to understand it, you're not going to be tripped up by this because you can figure out relatively quickly what it means. It means what? So we go back to the verse, Ruth chapter 2, verse 15. And when she had risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and reproach her not. And let fall also some of the handfuls of purpose for her, and leave them, that she may glean them, and rebuke her what? So is it pretty clear what's going on? Boaz is instructing his reapers that as they go out and reap the field, are they supposed to intentionally leave behind some handfuls on purpose for Ruth?
Knowingly.
They're doing it with, are they doing it on purpose, purposefully, or with knowledge? Because Boaz has just told them to what?
Do it.
To do it. Okay?
And he also instructed them to protect her because
yes.
If she would go to somewhere else, she wouldn't be under his protection. So
correct. So does she have an advantage
yeah.
in gleaning in Boaz's field than somebody else? Because has Boaz specifically instructed his reapers to behave in this way towards Ruth? Okay, Amy, was your hand up?
I find it interesting because, you know, she was a Gentile, right?
Ruth?
A Moabite.
She's a Moabite. I'm a little, it's been a while since I've read up on Ruth, but she, yes, I believe
she's from a different.
She's from a different area. Let's see if we can figure that out quick.
I'm just thinking of the parallel,
says in verse 41,
parallel
the roots
between
of
the Jews and the Gentiles and how the...
Yeah. So she is a Moabite, verse 21. So the issue here is this is an example of the doctrine or the idea in Israel's program of what's called Levirate marriage or the kinsman redeemer, right? So Ruth's husband has died, okay, and Boaz is her near kinsman, and so he is going, the whole idea here is that he is going to redeem Ruth, etc., and bring her back, and all this stuff is happening. This is all a type and a picture of different things that God said in the law to Israel and so on and so forth, okay? But that's sort of the bigger picture on what's going on. So what was your you had a follow-up point there, I think.
I'm just thinking of the parallel between this and Jesus called that Gentile lady a dog for eating the crumbs that fall from the table.
Yep. The Syrophoenician woman?
Yes.
Yes.
So she was allowed to glean...
She was there's a parallel there, but with the Syrophoenician woman, right? Where she, anyone recall the passage off the top of your head on that? Matthew 10. I was thinking 10, but that seemed too obvious. Let's see. Matthew 10 is when he commissions the apostles. So we'll do what I often do when I can't remember an exact. I'll search. I know the word crumbs is there. C-R-U-M-B-S, right? Crumbs. So I'm just going to go to Blue Letter Bible, search the word crumbs, and there it is, Matthew 15. Go to Matthew 15. Yep, you were almost there. Matthew 15, verse 21 is the verse. And Jesus went thence and departed into the coast of Tyre and Sidon, and behold, a woman of Canaan came out of the same coast and cried unto him, saying, Have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David, my daughter is grievously vexed with the devil. So this is clearly a Gentile woman. She's from Canaan. Notice how she approaches the Lord, though. She says, Oh, thou son of who?
David.
I think that's important. Verse 23, and he answered her not a word. So does the Lord initially ignore her?
Yep.
That's what the text says. And his disciples came and besought him, saying, Send her away, for she crieth after us. The disciples come and they're like, Lord, like, just get rid of this lady. She's bothering us. Okay? But he answered and said, I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Then came she and worshipped, saying, Lord, help me. So does she worship him as the Lord here?
Yeah.
Okay? But he answered and said, It is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. So in other words, is the Lord saying, she's, as a Canaanite woman, is she a Gentile dog that's not fit to eat the bread that, you know, is served on the master's table, so to speak, right? And he answered and said, It is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. And she said, Truth, Lord, yet the dogs eat the crumbs which fall from the master's table. Then Jesus answered and said unto her, O woman, great is thy faith, be it unto thee even as thou wilt. And her daughter was made whole from that very hour. So I think what you're saying here is there's a little bit of a parallel between Ruth being able to pick up the gleanings there from Boaz with what the Lord says here about the dogs eating the crumbs that fall from the master's table. So did you have another point there, Amy, other than to just point out the parallel, or was that were you just wanting us to note that? Because I think it's a good point. I'm not sure. I do think there's a parallel there, right? Is Ruth, as a Moabitess, is she being allowed to, in a figurative sense, eat the crumbs that are falling from Boaz's table? I think there's a legitimate comparison there. I do. Okay, go back to Ruth 2.
Yeah, actually, 2:2 tells that Ruth was a Moabitess right there. Let's say right
yeah.
There.
So I don't think that any of us have a hard time understanding the phrase handfuls of purpose. I do think, obviously, when we do a little bit of checking here, using a couple of the tools, we can, you know, see that a little bit, possibly a little bit more clearly, but I don't think that any of us would have struggled to understand that phrase.
It's the preposition of that throws you off. You know, in modern English, that wouldn't be correct at all. Handfuls is clearly handfuls of grain once you know that it's involved gleaning.
Right.
And then of purpose, it's on purpose, handfuls, purposely, or on purpose.
So back to this then, what you're saying then, Mike, is that the way we talk now,
yeah,
we would not use of in that way. We would use what? On. But clearly was of being used in a way back then to denote what we would now say as what?
On.
Okay? So it's pretty clear when you look at this that this word knowingly here means done of purpose, purposefully. It doesn't say intentionally, but obviously that would be included here, the concept of doing something intentionally. If you do it on purpose, are you doing it with intention?
Right.
Okay. AJ, was your hand up?
Yeah. So what is the salacious point of interest? I guess that's because I'm reading it, I know there's a...
So the salacious point of interest, you would ask. So let me try to... So I'm going to pull up Ruth 2:16. So here's the verse, right, that we're looking at. To use your language, not mine, the salacious point of interest is that you cannot adequately understand that verse in the King James because the language is dated. Okay, so readers of the King James will come to this and they'll say, you know, they won't adequately understand what that phrase means, and what they should consider doing instead is using a modern version in this, because you'll see here in the New American Standard, it says, also you are to, so here's verse 15, okay, When she got up to glean, Boaz commanded his servant, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. Also, you are to purposefully slip out for her some grain from the bundles." So the implication of the video in question was that the language is too archaic to be understood in the King James, and if you just went to a modern version, you would get the meaning of purposefully, because it explicitly says what? Purposefully. And so therefore the argument was posited or suggested that unless you're a skillful reader of the King James, there could be some meaning there that you're missing because you're not familiar with the construct of purpose, when a modern version would just tell you straight up that that's what's going on.
And I think some of this, though, is like Eli said, if you're taking it in context and you're reading it, that's what I do. If I miss something or I don't understand, I'll go back up and I'll take a couple, even a paragraph up if I'm reading a book, and say, okay, John Le Carre does this, and he often uses similes and pulls them out of nowhere from four chapters before. This isn't even that. This is literally
right
within two sentences.
Yeah, I agree. I forget the word you used, but that was the point of this particular video, was to say that most readers are going to be tripped up by that language because they're not familiar with it, and therefore not be able to understand it, and they're going to be missing some sort of shade of meaning there that is going to cause them to have ambiguity about the text that they wouldn't have if they were using a modern version. Go ahead.
Is this a grace person? Or
no.
Okay.
This is not.
Thank God.
this is not somebody of our, you know, dispensational persuasion, so to speak. Okay. But that's sort of, I just use that as an example to sort of as a test case to say to you guys, would you struggle with that? And what AJ brought up is what, in my opinion, most skillful readers of the Bible will do. If they don't, even if they're reading the King James, let's face it, okay? Are there certain words in the King James that are hard to understand?
Yes.
Is the King James more than 400 years old? So is there going to be some language, some forms of speaking that might be a little bit hard for us today, modern 21st century Americans, to get, and so are they going to require more work?
Yeah.
Okay? So what I'm trying to show you then are some strategies for how to still get the meaning there, even if you might originally be like, you know, what's going on with that word? Okay? Any questions? I could show you another one that comes to mind, if no one else has anything on that. Yeah. I believe Boaz is.
Okay, that's what I.
I'm going from memory here. I believe the answer is yes. I believe the answer is yes. If not, I'm sure I'll get corrected by the internet.
Well, one thing that I think is pretty true is with all the modern versions, there's less study involved. It's more relying on other people with some study. That's why they change a lot of the words, I think, to more modern forms or whatever. But when you're reading the King James, you're kind of forced to dig in for yourself and try to figure stuff out.
I would say that if you're going to read a King James Bible, you are probably going to have to resign yourself to the fact that there might be some extra study that you're going to have to do, research, to understand some things. Okay? Everybody go to Jeremiah 51. Let me show you another example here.
I just had another question before that. And then it says, she went out and planted ears of corn, whose sight I shall find grace. What does that mean?
She's referring to finding grace in the sight of Boaz.
Yeah, permission to glean in fields.
Yeah.
That
his favor.
So So you're kind of at the mercy of the prophet.
So ultimately, Boaz is going to marry Ruth. Okay, there's other things going on in that story that beyond just what my purpose in going there was for. My purpose in going there was not to teach the whole story of Ruth. It was just to look at that statement of purpose to look at it. Now here's another one. Okay. Now look with me at now let me be a little more specific here so we can hone in.
Now is Naomi related to Boaz? Is that
Boaz's kin? Naomi is related to Ruth, I believe.
Well, Naomi is Ruth's mother-in-law.
Right.
But isn't Naomi related to Boaz? And she's kind of acting as a...
So she's related to Boaz through marriage. Ruth's husband has died.
Yeah, but isn't Naomi Ruth's husband's mother? Not Ruth's mother. Because she chose to stay with Naomi.
Yes, you're right. You're
and that's why, and she's acting kind of like, hey, check out Boaz. He's a nice guy.
So she's aware of the Levirate stipulations in the law, yes.
Yeah. Because Boaz is really complimenting Ruth's unselfish care of Naomi. And that's how they, the connection yeah. that he's making. And
I should have read more of the story. I didn't.
My mother's name is Ruth, so I've gone.
Yeah, so you had an interest in
that. Yeah, the name is very interesting to me.
So let's look at another one of these. Everybody, look at Jeremiah 51. Jeremiah 51, verse 3. It says, "Against him that bendeth, let the archer bend his bow, and against him that lifteth up himself in his brigandine, and spare ye not your young men, destroy ye utterly all her host. Do not cheat." I see AJ already looking to cheat. I'm just kidding. What is a brigandine?
It's a military term, I believe.
What's a brigandine? So we have, it's a military term.
Armor.
You think it's armor?
Yeah. Well, the color is male.
Okay. Do you already know the answer, Mike?
Yeah.
Mike already knows the answer. Okay. Let's say you don't know the answer. So verse 51. Let's start this chapter 51, verse 1. So we know, so does it have something to do with military something? Okay. Look at verse 1. "Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up against Babylon and against them that dwell in the midst of them that raise up against me a destroying wind, and I will send unto Babylon fanners that fan her and shall empty her land, for in the day of trouble they shall be against her bout," verse 3, "and against him that bendeth, let the archer bend his bow." So it's talking about an archer shooting a what? A bow and arrow, right? "And against him that lifteth himself up in his brigandine, and spare ye not her young men, destroy ye utterly all her host." How many of you agree that that has something to do with military something?
Is that the defensive wall maybe that he's up on a brigandine?
Okay, so we've got somebody says armor, somebody says just a general military thing, somebody already knows the answer. But does it tell you what it is in the verse?
It gives you the context.
It gives you familiarity, right? It's got something to do with what?
Defense,
military, something. But does it explicitly tell you what a brigandine is?
No.
No. So let's go to another place. Let's go to Jeremiah 46. So we'll look for a cross-reference. Jeremiah 46. Verse 1, Jeremiah 46, verse 1, "The word of the Lord which came to Jeremiah the prophet against the Gentiles, against Egypt," "against the army of Pharaoh, Necho, king of Egypt, which was by the river Euphrates," okay, "which Nebuchadnezzar," I skipped the word on purpose, which "Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, smote in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Joash, king of Judah." So is it talking about an army of Egypt? Is it talking about him being smitten or smote in the fourth year of Jehoiakim? Verse 3, Order ye the buckler and shield and draw near to what? So is the context here military something? Battle. Verse 4, harness the horses and get up, ye horsemen, and stand forth with your helmets, furbish the spears, and put on the brigandines. So, does it check out that it has something to do with military something? But that does it still tell us what it means? It's something you put on. We know that. There's another clue. You put on the, you put it on. It's something you put on. Right? But do we use the word brigandine anymore?
All the time.
All the time. Eli says all the time. So let's just look at. So now, is this a case where you know that you need to go look at a dictionary? Okay, because you don't know what a brigandine is, so we're going to go to the OED, and we're going to type, we're going to enter brigandine. Okay, so is this a noun or an adjective? What do we think this is?
Noun.
Okay, so we'll look at the noun entry. And we're going to just search for the word Bible here. Ooh, look at that. Does it pull something from the Bible? And does it pull something from Jeremiah? And does it pull something from the verse we just looked at? Furbish the spears and put on what? The brigandines. All right, so what is this definition? It is body armor composed of iron rings or small thin iron plates sewed upon canvas, linen, or other leather to cover over with similar materials. So what is a brigandine? It's chainmail is what it is. Okay? Now, but do you know the word brigandine? I didn't know what a brigandine was until I was. I knew it had military something. I knew it was something you put on, but I didn't know explicitly what it was. So now do I know because I can read the word brigandine and know I'm not familiar with that word that I need to go look the word up? So what do? I look it up and do I find the answer? So the fact that it's chainmail, does it fit the context of something in use in military conflict and something that somebody would have to put on?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not hard. I know I don't know the word, so I what?
Check around.
Just go look it up. Okay. I can compare scripture with scripture. I go to the other occurrence, and I know, well, that helps me out in the sense that I know it's something that somebody puts on. All right. But it's not immediately clear, and so now I know that I have to look it up. So there's a strategy there. You don't know what the verse is. You don't know what a word is. What should you do? Search and see if a form of that word occurs somewhere else. Look at it there, see if it helps you. If after you do that and you're still not helped, now do you know you need to go grab a dictionary? Now, I'm using the OED, which I admittedly pay for, but I could go equally to the Webster's Dictionary, which is free online. I could type in brigandine, and I could see that it's a coat of what? A coat of mail. The name has ceased to be used, okay? With its disuse of the thing, it consisted of thinly joined scales of plate, okay? So it's chainmail is what it is. So were the ancient Israelites apparently using an early form of chainmail in their military battles against the different enemies of Israel? The answer is apparently what? Yes. Okay. So one of my main things here is just to kind of try to keep this informal and just show you how to think about if you encounter words in the King James that you don't understand, what kinds of different things you should try as far as to help yourself figure out what they mean. Okay?
You know, my Bible, this is a King James Bible, and my Bible has footnotes by it.
Some do.
Because his doesn't, behind us. Because by brigandine, it's got the letter T, and then you go down here and it says armor. So then when you go back, to 46, where it says brigandine, the footnote, then it says chainmail.
So... chainmail. So yeah, I mean, if you have a Bible that does that, then you don't need to do what we just did, but mine doesn't do that, so, you know, you just do a little bit of work, and you can figure out the answer. Yeah?
So, because it
of the I perceive one of the points of the video about Ruth was what you said, that you shouldn't have to do all of this stuff to understand it, because it says in the New American Standard Bible purposely. So you don't. So the Bible, in other words, should speak in the language of the people that are reading it, and we don't use the phrase of purpose anymore. So therefore, you know, you're potentially missing meaning by the use of that phrase. And so what you should do, according to the creator of this video, is you should get a modern version and remove the ambiguity.
What if you're reading any sort of other book and found a word that you didn't understand, you just look it up?
There are words in the NIV and all these other modern versions that people don't understand that they're going to need to look up. So it's not, to me, a lot of it is an inherent problem with just language in general, and the way language works, and the way, you know, the meanings of words.
The more I see the other versions, I'm more inclined to put them to the test and look things up there, especially when you know, for instance, the NIV is pulling out the blood of Christ. So I don't trust much of anything else. So if I come to something, like if I'm doing a comparative Bible and I'm looking at verses, if I'm scanning that, or if all I have access to is an NIV, I'm going to question just about everything. Whereas here, at least, I can, if I do one lookup, hey, I didn't understand the word, now I do know. Maybe we should wear a little button to say, bring back Burgundy. I mean, it's an inside joke, but it's not that big a deal.
We run out of time. Let's just address this blood of Christ comment just quick. Okay? Mm-hmm. So everybody grab Colossians chapter 1. Grab Colossians chapter 1 and Ephesians chapter 7. No, said that wrong. Ephesians 1 verse 7 and Colossians chapter 1. Get Colossians 1 and Ephesians 1. So, if you look at Colossians 1:14, so let me call this up. I'm going to have to make this point quick because we're going to have to, which of course I can't ever make any points quick, but so we're going to call up Colossians 1:14 in the NIV, for example. I think. Come on. All right, so your King James says, in whom we have redemption through his what? Blood, even the forgiveness of sins. Look at the NIV. In whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of what? What's missing? Okay. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 7. In whom we have redemption through his what?
Blood.
All right, so let's look at that verse in the NIV. Here's Ephesians 1:7 in the NIV. In whom we have redemption through his what?
Blood.
Okay, so what the pro-modern version advocates will say is they will say this. Well, yeah, the blood of Christ is not in Colossians 1:14, but it's in Ephesians 1:7. And what a scribe did is they were familiar with Ephesians 1:7, and when they're copying Colossians 1:14, they inadvertently add the phrase through his blood to Colossians 1:14 to harmonize Colossians 1:14 with Ephesians 1:7. But the original text of Colossians 1:14 did not have the phrase through his blood, because the oldest and best witnesses tell us this. That's what they're going to say. Okay? To which I would simply say, well, the Colossians, have they ever seen Paul?
No.
No.
Go to Colossians 1, go to Colossians 2, verse 1. For I would that ye know what great conflict I have for you and for them at Laodicea, and as for as many as have not seen my face, where? Has Paul ever been to Colossae?
No.
So I scratch my head and I say, so, do the Colossians need to know that redemption is through the blood of Christ?
Yeah.
So what modern text, what the modern text critical community does is they now, they come to something like this and they realize that the King James only group is going to charge this with the removal of the critical phrase through his blood. And so then they come up with a reason to explain why that's not a big deal. And they say, well, the scribe here, he's harmonizing Ephesians 1 and Colossians 1, and he just inadvertently adds it. But it really wasn't in the regular, in the original text, to which I say, well, then why is it in a whole bunch of manuscript witnesses? And do the Colossians need to know a group that has never seen Paul's face in the flesh? He's never been there and preached to them himself. Do they need to know that redemption is through his blood? I would say that they do. And so what ends up happening is they end up creating these situations that to me don't make any sense when you think about the fact that Ephesians and Colossians were they originally written as separate epistles to two different churches. And then later on were they collected together and put into the canon. You see what I'm saying? So like, yeah, a lot of the stuff, AJ, ends up not making a whole lot of sense. Okay? Now I do realize that I just took a risk in going there because of time's sake. And I see I have another question here that I'm probably not going to... If you have a question, save it for next week, because I'm just being upfront with you. This week again, with another holiday tomorrow and going back to school later in the week, we're going to have another sort of informal lesson next Sunday as well. So if you have any other questions, make sure that you bring them or send them.